You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Very excited to be speaking this next half hour with Professor John Hall of UW-Madison. He is the Ambrose Husseltine Professor of U.S. Military History, and he focuses on how societies use organized violence, military violence, if you will, to pursue and defend their interests. We're going to get in maybe to a little bit about what's been said and is going on with those boats in the Caribbean, but I want to start at a very basic level, John. In the United States, we have had a tradition of civilian control of the military and a norm that the military has always, in its inception and in the manner that it executes its duties and fulfills each individual service member's oaths to the Constitution, that it should be, in all matters, apolitical. How do you think we're faring under this current administration in maintaining those critically important standards?
Well, I think that it is doing a creditable job so far. So I, not without exceptions to that, but I think the longer that people have been in the American Professional Arms, the better that they have absorbed and internalized this professional military ethic, which, as you indicate, I mean, dates to very early American history. And this was in evidence when the Secretary of Defense and the President addressed the senior leaders of the U.S. military, one stars and up in command billets and along with their senior enlisted leaders. You could see that that crowd was abiding by that professional military ethic. You can see it every year when presidents give the State of the Union address and you have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the other Joint Chiefs sitting there in the front row with their hands on their laps, looking stoic, not smiling, not applauding. And that is what the Constitution doesn't explicitly call for that, but that is what the norm in this country calls for. It is worth pointing out, though, that the ideal of an apolitical military has not always been the fact. Back to the founding of the Republic, it was the case that the first two political parties in this country, the Federalists and the Jeffersonian Republicans, predecessors to today's modern Democratic Party, the army of that era was overwhelmingly Federalist. It's persuasion. And there have been other times. There's that is between what your individual political beliefs are and whether or not that actually influences.
John, I'm going to jump in. We're having a little bit of trouble hearing you, so I'm going to suggest that you give us a call directly. If you look in the studio chat, we've got the direct line to our studios so that you can call in. And I wanted to help clarify a little bit about what the professor was saying. Of course, I pointed to and have pointed to multiple times on this program that what Mr. Hegseth was saying to military leadership was not apolitical. What Donald Trump said to military leadership at Quantico was not apolitical. That he that they're missing that, right? But what John is saying is when you looked at that room, what you saw was that the military commanders themselves were not responding, either an affirmation or an objection to the politicized statements being made by those various folks, whether that was Defense Secretary Hegseth or Donald Trump in that moment. Welcome back, John. Thanks for calling in. Just want you to reset a little bit. And I was sharing with folks what you were explaining before it got a little spotty there, was that when you look at the Quantico speeches given by Secretary of Defense Hegseth and President Trump, when you looked at the military leadership in that room and you referenced the State of the Union addresses, they don't applaud. They basically are non-reactive. That is the symbolic embodiment of this apolitical civilian-led military that you and I are talking about here, that they are effectively non-reactive to statements that are highly politicized. And we saw that in that Quantico meeting. If there was a silver lining in the meeting, I would suggest respectfully that it was we saw those one stars and above, those generals not reacting to highly politicized or partisan statements.
Right, that's exactly the case. So you have seen other spectacles, though, in the second administration. So shortly before the Army's birthday parade in Washington, D.C., which some people allege was also a presidential birthday parade, but not long before that, the president went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and used a bunch of soldiers from Fort Bragg as a backdrop there. And when you're dealing with junior enlisted soldiers, they don't receive the same kind of education, right? I mean, they're not yet fully incorporated into the profession of arms. And most of the reporting at the time also indicated that the people who participated in what was, for all intents and purposes, a rally were screened based upon their fondness for this particular commander-in-chief and his policies. And so that was, I think, the counterpoint to the display of professionalism that you saw at Quantico. I would not say that this is a display of unprofessionalism on the part of the soldiers of the 82nd Airborne Division, but I mean, it was a select crowd that arguably did not know better. Unfortunately, I think that gave the Army a black eye, gave Fort Bragg a black eye, because all of the people that were present there should have been reminded about the imperative of appearing apolitical. And so the president's more recent public appearance with a lot of junior enlisted from the U.S. Navy at an event celebrating the Navy's birthday, there you had all ranks, but again, the response to what were sort of kind of campaign rally provocations did not receive the same warm responses that they got at Fort Bragg.
Yeah, as a person spends increasing amount of time and certainly, becomes a leader in the military, the criticalness, the centrality of that fundamental apolitical nature of the military becomes much more part of your day-to-day, the ephemera, the air you breathe. It is truly internalized. Our youngest soldiers and fighters aren't quite there yet, as you so rightly explained. I wanted to ask you your thoughts, having as an expert in military history, this we've seen just in the last 2 weeks, two extraordinary resignations. Admiral Alvin Halsey, 37 years, resigned his job as the head of the U.S. Southern Command right at the time that the U.S. under Donald Trump is mobilizing some 10,000 plus troops. There have been these missile attacks on boats. There seems to be rumblings of some kind of declaration of war, perhaps with Venezuela, yet Congress hasn't really been briefed. It's this vague area. There was reporting that he resigned after those 37 years because he was incredibly uncomfortable about those missions and those attacks and the legal basis on which they stand. In addition, the day of that Quantico presentation, September 30th, Marine Colonel Doug Krugman resigned after 24 years, wrote a scathing piece in the Washington Post. You can deal with either or both of those resignations. Are we seeing indications? Of course, Colonel Krugman's was quite public. Less public was Admiral Halsey's, though his resignation was reported. Are there indications that there are senior members of our military, regardless of branch, that are getting increasingly uncomfortable with some of these efforts to overtly politicize the military?
Well, I think undoubtedly there's tremendous discomfort. So the senior leaders of the military had already obviously dealt with this commander-in-chief for 4 years under his first administration, and it posed unique challenges in civil-military relations at the time. 2017, there was a meeting in the tank, the meeting room in the Pentagon where the senior leaders meet with the president Widely reported, Washington Post, a couple of books have mentioned this meeting in which senior leaders tried to, you know, convince President Trump of the benefits of the international rules-based system that the United States helped engineer after World War II, and of which the United States remains to this day the primary beneficiary. And the president would not have it because it was an orthodoxy, a bipartisan orthodoxy post-World War II that is utterly anathema to President Trump's worldview. And he let them know as much. And so this, you know, from that early day, I think senior leadership was kind of on a back foot because it was a challenge to fundamental truths and a vision of the world and America's place in the world and a strategic center of gravity or alliances and so forth. And so military leaders have the right as citizens to vote, and they have an obligation then that whomever wins the election and the electoral college and is the lawful constitutional commander in chief, and they've got to obey those orders, but not irrespective of individual officers' votes. I have to believe that the Pentagon was sort of bracing for impact when they learned that a second Trump administration was coming in. And granted, I'm talking about the uppermost sort of tiers of leadership, yes, which includes civilian leadership in the departments of the different services and the Department of Defense. But everybody sort of knew what was probably going to come, and that was a president who had 4 years to figure out how to overcome the frustrations of the first 4 years. And that meant something of a temple cleansing. And so you've seen him move very, very quickly to effect this temple cleansing. And at Quantico, when the Secretary of Defense tells everybody, if you don't like what you're hearing, do the honorable thing and walk, I think they would like nothing better than that. I think that both President and the Secretary of Defense, when they looked out at the room, they were looking out at a corporate body that they had learned to distrust. And I think that they would probably be happy if a great, great many of the people who were in that room submitted their resignations or retired. The difference between the Marine colonel who you referenced, who yes, you know, publicly stated his reasons for doing this and you know, published them for a national media audience, and the senior most officers who are retiring prematurely, is that we don't know in every instance if these senior officers were being compelled to retire prematurely before their terms are up. In their training in civil military relations, most of them are taught that it is dangerous for them to resign in protest, that amounts to an act of civil military disobedience, because they're constitutionally legal commanders have the authority to tell them to do what they want to do.
And when we come back, we're going to continue this. We've got to take care of a couple messages. We're with Professor John Hall, a military historian. We're going to continue to dig into civil-military relations, as well as the National Guard deployments and the weird legal limbo that we collectively as Americans find ourselves in. Don't go anywhere. This critically important discussion continues on the other side. Might the National Guard be coming to this state? What do we make of that? Next, right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm joined for the balance of this half hour by Professor John Hall of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is a professor of military history and the Ambrose Heseltine Professor of U.S. Military History, to be specific. John, thanks so much for sticking around with us. Help me understand, and all of us to understand, in context, how unusual or not these multiple deployments of National Guard to various, frankly, Democratic-leaning large cities is, and what role, if any, military, including National Guard or regular active-duty troops, have under our constitutional structure in civilian law enforcement. Put this in context for us.
Yeah, I mean, this is very unusual in modern times. In recent history, you haven't really seen much like this. And the fact that the president has said rather explicitly that one of his motivations for doing this is overtly political. He sees this as damaging Democratic mayors and governors and thinks that it redounds to his credit as being tough on crime, and it thinks it plays to his base, which is why you're only seeing these deployments to cities that are governed by Democratic politicians, irrespective of the crime rates there vis-a-vis other cities. One of the ironic things is one of the reasons we have a constitution, though, is because under the Articles of Confederation, the founders discovered that they didn't actually have the means to respond to civil disturbances with military force if they needed to. Right after the Revolution, Shays' Rebellion in 1786 was this shocking moment in which it looked like they just won their independence and they can't overcome a simple farmer rebellion. And that's one of the reasons why they actually had a constitutional convention, was because they recognized they needed a stronger central government. And as early as 1792, Congress passed the first of what would become cumulatively known as the Insurrection Acts, again, because it was a fragile young nation, and they could not afford to let it be toppled from within by domestic acts of disobedience. And Washington used that law in 1794 to put down what's known as the Whiskey Rebellion. So the Constitution actually does authorize the use of military to put down domestic combinations, was a word they used a lot back then. But the bar historically has been higher than this. I mean, this is where much of the debate lies, is what going on tantamount to a rebellion, an insurrection, an invasion. The president purposefully uses all of those words because that provides the legal, he hopes, for these deployments. But ultimately, it's going to be up to the courts to determine whether or not it meets that burden.
What do you make of the fact that we, right now, as you and I sit here and discuss this, we've got a circuit split. We've got the Ninth Circuit that is permitting, at least on a temporary basis, deployments of National Guard based on Trump's basically unilateral blanket assertion that there are rebellions. And the Seventh Circuit has said no, that they're just, the facts don't make out a rebellion, that protest, even protest that includes incidental acts of violence, even if there's some coordination, unless its purpose is to topple the government, it ain't a rebellion. What do you make of this weird, bizarre legal moment that we're in, where there's different rules that are being applied in Illinois versus California and Oregon at the moment?
Yeah, well, I think you're far better qualified to answer that question than I am, as I'm a simple military historian rather than a legal scholar. But I mean, I do think it reflects a divided opinion about the amount of authority that is inherent in the office of the commander in chief. And historically, a great many judges have deferred to a more liberal view, although that's an interesting choice of words, I recognize, a more expansive view. More expansive view of the presidential prerogative to make these determinations. The benefit of the doubt, devolves.
Has inured in the past to the federal government, to the president making those assertions. It's fascinating to me when you parse the language in these decisions as well as the lower court decisions. You see some courts expressing skepticism. From a military, historical military perspective, if the executive engages in outright falsehoods as a factual pretext for military action, what roles do either frontline, service members or top level leaders have in the military to raise an objection? Like, how does that work? And I'm sorry to ask you this question, sir, with just a smidge over a minute left. Do your best if you can.
Yeah,
I'd love to have you back.
Very quickly. I mean, I think you saw the best way that they should do this during the George Floyd protests in 2020, when senior militaries military leaders effectively dissuaded the Trump administration from deploying active duty troops to Washington, D.C. But the president resented that, right? That's part of what I've mentioned earlier, sort of 4 years to plot a new way as he came back in. And so at present, the military commanders are going to have to do whatever the courts adjudge in these circumstances. But it may come to a point in which they are going to have to make a decision between what the law says, because the legal standard is that manifestly illegal orders, they should not disobey. But what about their ethics? And some of them, I think, are already running up against ethical barriers.
Folks, that is Professor John Hall, Professor of Military History, the Ambrose Heseltine Professor from University of Wisconsin-Madison. John, I'd love to have you come back soon, because this ain't going nowhere fast. These are the big questions for our constitutional republic. My thanks to you, sir. When we come back on the other side, I'm going to continue to dig in to the corruption, these questions about what's going to happen in Gaza. Has there always been a long-term plan for Jared Kushner to basically build hotels there? And to whose benefit exactly? We discuss next. Don't go anywhere. I'm Maggie Dawn, and you're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Just wanted to share with you, got one of my lively conservatives on the text line. It's pelting me with multiple texts about, why are Democrats so afraid of the National Guard helping to fight crime? Thank you, Donald J. Trump. Mark from Sussex, love it when you participate. Everybody out there, you can participate as well. Text and phone lines are open, 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. Here are my responses to Mark from Sussex. I'm not afraid of reducing crime. Everybody wants less crime. Of course we do. Everybody wants their families to be safe. Everybody wants to walk the streets, go to work, have their kids play outside and be safe. Let's not act like Republicans want or deserve more safety than Democrats do. Where we disagree is not in the value that we all deserve safety, but in the means of getting there. That the means, the how, matters. So here are some of the reasons that I have a problem with the National Guard being deployed in this way, aside from the illegality of it, aside from the fact that, in my opinion and the opinion of the Seventh Circuit, the legal predicates that are required under 10 U.S.C. 12406 for National Guard deployments have not been met. There is no rebellion. Okay? Here are the other reasons why. Because the Supreme Court of the United States just said that racial profiling is okay, and it's not. Because they are arresting citizens. Because they are using excessive force, because the National Guard is not trained for civilian law enforcement, because Guards members didn't sign up to squash protests by their neighbors and scare people into surrendering their First Amendment rights, because it's unnecessary, because it's performative, because it's a waste of money, because it's the behavior of a dictator, because most of all, it's ineffective, and it won't do a damn thing to reduce crime in any of these cities in any meaningful or lasting way. That's why I object to it. I don't object to more safety. Hell yes, we all deserve that. But if we're being honest, the how matters, the means matters. And it should matter to every single one of us, not just Democrats. And by the way, like I said yesterday, Democrats don't care about the means only because they care about Democrats. They care about the means because they care about everybody, because it matters in our democracy, because presidents just don't get to make up lies and send the military willy-nilly into cities where people vote overwhelmingly not for them. And by the way, Mark, no, the analysis that I have seen of the DC National Guard deployments do not support a conclusion that there has been meaningful reduction in violent crime. That is incorrect. Please drop a source I've looked at reporting from the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic. So right now, Mark, if you believe that, it is my understanding that that is a false belief. You can believe it. You can believe it strongly. It can be your very intense feeling that it's better in Washington, D.C. But if that's not actually true, doesn't that matter to you? Shouldn't it matter? And by the way, you're not making that argument about LA or Portland or Chicago. It's not helpful. And even if it were helpful for a day, a week, a month, they are going to leave and it won't be helpful in the long term. It will not provide meaningful or lasting reduction in crime. And Mark, if you swear at me again on the text line, you will be barred. I'm not dealing with swearing. I'm not dealing with name calling. It is not acceptable. I'm trying to have a reasoned argument with you. By the way, you should just call me up, 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. Brett from Brown Deer, welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show. What do you got for us this afternoon?
Hi, Maggie. My first 3 years in my military career, I joined the National Guard, and I was trained a little bit on crowd control. I wasn't trained how to arrest. I wasn't trained how probable cause, civil rights. I was trained how to shoot field artillery. That has no need on the streets.
There you go, Mark. Straight from Brett's mouth. He served in the Guard. That's not what they're trained to do. 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. Charles from Milwaukee, you're up next, sir. Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon, Maggie. If I'm correct, I don't think the Coast Guard, the military, I don't think they went into the rough neighborhoods of D.C.
That's what I'm talking about. If you look at either the crime impacts, I'm just not seeing what Mark is believes very strongly as the case.
Right.
He will not drop me a citation. You're making an additional point, Charles, which is where they were deployed was performative. They weren't deploying the Guard into the high crime areas of Washington, D.C. for the very reason that Brett just pointed out. Because they don't know what probable cause is. They don't know how to detain. And because, oh yes, we have a law called the Posse Comitatus Act, which means literally the National Guard can't engage in civilian law enforcement. So, none of it makes any damn sense. The rationale just doesn't hold.
No. And if the National Guard, I pray he doesn't send the National Guard to Milwaukee. But let's just say he sends the National Guard to Milwaukee. You think the National Guard and FBI are going to be patrolling the streets to stop their young kids that are stealing cars and running red lights? Or are they going
to be there
to make sure that the ICE agents are able to rough people up the way they've been doing? That's what this is all about, protecting ICE. All these people have to do is listen to Donald Trump. Donald Trump spills the beans all the time. All you got to do is let him talk, and he's going to tell it all. They're there to protect ICE and allow ICE to be the thugs that they are. They're not
to allow ICE. I will just say this. We got a bunch of callers on the horn, so I'm going to hop in here. To allow ICE to engage in systematic daily abuse, use of excessive force, stripping of people's civil rights, lack of due process, which various courts have ordered is required. Again, it is still a crime for either police or National Guards members or ICE or the FBI to engage in excessive force, right? And at certain levels, it is a big, serious crime. Mark points this out, and I'll grant Mark this point. He actually made one, so congrats, Mark. Even a blind squirrel finds a nut once in a while. He says, presence of law enforcement is a deterrent. Yes, but Mark, then see the point that Charles from Milwaukee just made. Then why wasn't the National Guard deployed in Washington, D.C. in the most violent areas of Washington, D.C.? They weren't. Find me a source that says they were. I will talk about it with you. We have got Jeff from East Troy on the line. Hey, Jeff, what you got for us?
Hi. So I don't want to talk about the National Guard other than I am a conservative, and that's not my point, but I I am on the feeling that the National Guard can help, but that's not what I'm calling about. What I'm calling about is the shutdown, the government shutdown, and why. I know why the Democrats say they are shutting down, but if you listen to them in the past, it's very contradictory. If you listen to any of Chuck Schumer in the past, he has said you don't hold America hostage. But that's not even my point. My point is I wish the media would get on board with trying to urge and help both sides. I recently heard that there is a bipartisan bill in Congress right now that states that if the once we are back not being shut down anymore, that and I'm hoping that this proposal goes through. That's why I'm calling, is to get everybody on board, both Republicans and Democrats on board, and urging all their congressmen, both Democrats and Republicans, to get on board with going to the Medicare, Medicaid part, or actually the Obamacare, of subsidizing Obamacare for one full year under the current law or current
rate. Jeff, let me ask you, what happens after the year? What happens after a year? And by the way,
that's the other part of this bill that I haven't gotten to yet. So
let me just ask you this, Jeff. Hang on. Let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. What is happening in 2026 that might induce Republicans to restore the subsidies because their constituents might get really mad? What's happening in 2026?
Well, because of Obamacare, which was a very
No. It's a pretty simple answer. The midterms. It's an incredibly cynical ploy.
Sure. But let's get on board with both sides with this bill, a bipartisan bill, where we will resubsidize Obamacare for one full year, and they are delving into the problems of Obamacare that make it so expensive.
Okay, hang on, Jeff. I gotta step in there because I've got some sound that exactly responds to what you're talking about, okay? Because here it is, Jeff. Donald Trump controlled both houses of Congress in his first term. They did not repeal and replace Obamacare. They didn't do anything to improve it. In fact, they attacked the mandate, which has made it much more expensive for everybody. Let's listen to Republicans fail to propose anything to make the Affordable Care Act better. Jacob, run for the man, cut 39, please. Jeff, hang on the phone.
If you have ideas and you have plans, why not have that out there to talk about in the public so the people can hear that debate happening? I mean, you could have committees in session right now.
They will, Caitlin.
I think the question is on the health care plan, to Marjorie Taylor Greene's point, is if the government reopened tonight, would Republicans have a plan to address the Obamacare subsidies?
Yes. Yes, yes.
You
yes,
would have
we
a plan
do. We
tonight.
Have proposals to, yeah, we
okay,
could have that ready immediately.
Plan.
Yes. Yeah, because here's the thing. We work in a deliberative public body, and we have hundreds of members. It's a very complicated, very complex issue that requires a long time to build consensus around. We have ideas on the table, and the whole process of the legislative body is to build consensus around it. That's why we have to do that, and that's what we've been planning to do all along.
And Republicans have said, repeal and replace, and it's like we're in a wilderness. Republicans are in the wilderness on what to do to try to
actually, we're not. We're not. We've got pages and pages and pages of ideas on how to reform healthcare.
Yes or no, you still do not have a plan.
I have concepts of a plan. I have concepts of a plan. I have concepts of a plan.
So, Jeff, my question to you is this. Republicans controlled both houses of Congress during Trump's first administration. They control both houses of Congress now. Instead, hang on. Let me finish asking my question, sir. Instead of passing tax cuts for billionaires and megacorporations, passing the big brutal bill, why didn't they take that time to fix the ACA if they're so concerned about the subsidies? No, sir. They passed a bill to remove the subsidies. Make it make sense to me, Jeff.
Okay, so that's what I'm calling for, is for both sides to get together and agree. Well,
okay, I do agree. Jeff's going to hang on the phone. Richard from Waukesha, we got CJ on the line, and Mark from Prairie du Sac. You can get on the action too. 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
I'm hopping right on in here, folks, because the phone lines are popping. We got Jeff, a conservative from East Troy, on the line. He's telling me Democrats and Republicans, they got to get together, restore these ACA subsidies. And my questions to you, Jeff, have been, Republicans had plenty of opportunity during Trump 1.0 to repeal and replace Obamacare. They didn't. Republicans could have repealed and replaced Obamacare. Instead, they passed the big, brutal bill, and they decided to remove the ACA subsidies. I played you the sound that's, we got concepts of a plan. We got pages and pages of ideas. We got all these things. But I see no plan. I see nothing written down to make healthcare more quality, higher quality, or more affordable for Americans. And Jeff, your first point to me was, well, Democrats have done this before. The circumstances here are extraordinary and different from any time in the past. You got 15 million Americans that might lose their health insurance. And say what you want about the quality of health insurance. We all agree that health insurers, the for-profit ones, are nasty pieces of work. But where's the plan? And by the way, here is a bit of sound about, if you want to call it Democratic hypocrisy about this, then you got to call out GOP hypocrisy about this. Jacob, if you can, play my friend Jeff, cut 29.
Families will suffer, but this is only one of only the leverage times that we have. She said that in her own words, and it was pretty shocking today to hear them say that. They usually don't say the quiet parts out loud.
You're saying Democrats are making that argument, talking about what Catherine Clark said today. I do want you to listen. We've heard an argument similar to that one before.
Why shouldn't we be trying to force this government shutdown fight to get something out of it that's good for the American people?
How else are you going to get moderates to vote for spending cuts if they're not up against the fact that they need to pass these things to get out of a shutdown themselves?
A lot of good can come down from shutdowns.
I'm just asking. Jeff dropped. He texted me instead. He said, instead of putting down a side, I'm going to put down Republicans because Republicans passed the big brutal bill. Republicans are the ones that removed the subsidies for the Affordable Care Act. Republicans did that, not Democrats. Republicans are the ones that are refusing to negotiate in good faith with Democrats right now. Republicans cynically propose, oh, well, we'll restore the subsidies for a year so we don't get, you know, punished during midterms for what our actual policies are, which is handouts for billionaires and mega corporations. CJ from Stoughton, what you got for us?
Well, thanks for taking my call, Maggie. Day 24 of the Tammy Baldwin Chuck Schumer shutdown.
Get to the point, so, CJ.
Well, here's the facts. Page 57, section 21.
Okay, I have rebutted that. That is a falsehood. Page 57 of whatever the hell CJ is talking about, we will drop the citation to when I debunked that completely and entirely. Here's what the Republicans did in the big brutal bill. They inserted language that made it look like they were making it illegal for the first time for folks that are undocumented to receive Medicare, Medicaid, and the ACA. Except, CJ, that was already written into the law. So if you cared actually about having an argument with me, you would avail yourself of the resources that I've provided to you in the past and taken great pains to explain, because when you actually bring me substance, I will go look it up, unlike you, who doesn't engage with the substance. That is a lie. It is a misdirection, and it is yet again Republican callousness that assumes that Americans are stupid enough to not do their research. So let's work together to actually know what is and is not being proposed. There is nothing, nothing that is in the Senate Democrat-sponsored CR that would make it legal. Nothing. for undocumented people to receive Medicare, Medicaid, or ACA benefits in a new way. The only way that that happens is through EMTALA, which was a Reagan piece of legislation. Democrats aren't changing that at all. Go away, CJ, because I'm not arguing this point with you anymore. Thank you very much. Linda from Waukesha, go ahead, ma'am. Linda, you there? Hello, Linda from Waukesha. Are you there? All right, moving right along. We got Mark from Prairie du Sac up next on the phone lines. Hey, Mark.
Yeah, thanks. If they want to cut down on crime, how about not pardoning guys who have committed these massive financial frauds, cheating people out of their money? I mean, that those people that got cheated out, you know, their money didn't get submitted to the for their taxes. And what, is Trump going to come along and say, you got to pay these taxes because we never got them? I can see Trump doing that, but I mean that, and these people can't go back and sue the people that damaged them because Trump pardoned them.
Mark, I made this exact point with another one of our conservative texters that I call Conservative Bob. I said, Bob, what do you make of Donald Trump pardoning white collar fraud who has fraudsters since he's been since he took over in January to the tune of $1.3 billion? That they owed to their victims in restitution, that Donald Trump just waved a magic wand and said, I pardon you, you can get out of prison, and you don't have to pay regular people the $1.3 billion that they're owed. But he wants taxpayers to pay him $250 million for arguments that he should have made in his criminal cases that he never did because he knew they were bogus and would eventually fall apart. But now that he's in the big chair, he'll cut himself $250 million check. I'm just so tired of this nonsense. And let's just finish with this little tidbit since I didn't get to squeeze it in earlier. Jacob, let's let everybody know who's actually always responsible for the shutdowns.
Well, if you say who gets fired, it always has to be the top. I mean, problems start from the top and they have to get solved from the top. And the president's the leader and he's got to get everybody in a room and he's got to lead. You know, the interesting thing is in 25 years and 50 years and 100 years from now, when the government is, you know, they talk about the government shutdown, they're going to be talking about the president of the United States. Who was the president?
Yeah, Donald, it's you. You're responsible for the shutdown. Restore the subsidies, negotiate in good faith since you're such the big negotiator, and stop telling the American public lies. Folks, if you want to hear my takedown of the conservative lie about page 57 and all that nonsense, go to today's show notes. We're going to put the link into that show in the show notes today. You can find those wherever you find my podcasts. That's going to do it for me. Pete Schwab is up next.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.